realized that was the same face. Here was the offensive coach screaming at the defense when they're coming off the field after allowing the Packers to score. That was his immediate reflection. It jumped right out at him, and it brought a smile to Starr's face. This Vince Lombardi, he thought to himself, is no Scooter McLean. Chapter 12. Packers Sweep. The Lombardis drove to Green Bay as a family, but only the father and son showed the slightest desire to go. Marie couldn't suppress the tears when her husband steered their two-tone Chevy toward the turnpike to begin their long trek to Wisconsin. As she rode west on this dreary February day in 1959, she was separating from her family, friends, Fifth Avenue clothing stores, Midtown restaurants, Monmouth Racetrack, St. James Church, Atlantic Ocean, everything she'd ever known. Her first impressions of Green Bay, which she'd visited with Vince during a brief reconnaissance trip the previous week, hadn't made the leave-taking easier. She told the local press then that Green Bay reminded her of Fairhaven, but in truth she found it to be a shudderingly alien place. Sunshine glancing off blinding white snowdrifts when they had walked down the steps of the North Central Airlines plane onto the tarmac at Austin's Strobel Airport, the temperature at zero, the landscape lunar and desolate. This little man known as Ole greeting them and escorting them in a car caravan along Ridge Road and Highland Avenue, past City Stadium and down to the neighborhoods of Alloway and De Pere, a trooper pulling them over for not coming to a complete stop at a stop sign. The people, friendly, nosy, talking to her in sing-song tones and slow rhythms as though they were reciting fairy tales to children. Was this the beginning or end? Winnebago Indian legend held that humans first came to Earth just north of modern-day Green Bay, brought by thunder and lightning. But Alexis de Tocqueville, paddling into the wilds of nearby Duck Creek River during his 1831 tour of America, declared that he had reached the perilous edge of Western civilization and was ready to turn back. Marie Lombardi was of a similar mind during the trip west, and as she cried in the front seat, her 12-year-old daughter sobbed behind her. Green Bay was beyond Susie's imagination of the world. She remembered when her dad spread the map and tried to show the kids their new home, and he couldn't find it himself at first. Vincent bristled at his sister's sobbing and retaliated by battling over every inch of territory in the back seat. Not just Susie was back there, but also her favorite stuffed animal, a huge white bear. He would push the white bear down into the space below his sister's feet, and she would start to cry again, and the old man would get that look in the rearview mirror and order him to stop it, mister. Vincent was almost 17, midway through his junior year in high school, ready for an adventure away from the demanding Red Bank nuns. Football was his life almost as much as his father's, and he viewed Green Bay as an opportunity for both of them. His parents had already told him about the first question a reporter had asked at the airport earlier that month, a query that concerned not the new coach, but his namesake kid. "Mr. Lombardi, what high school will your son enroll in?" the reporter had blurted out, and nervous laughter had filled the airport lounge because of the football subtext. What school would be lucky enough to get the bruising young fullback out of Red Bank Catholic? On the morning of their third day on the road, the Lombardis rounded Chicago and crossed Wisconsin's southern border. As they approached Milwaukee, the scenery changed dramatically to white on white, and Vincent and Susan looked out in disbelief and despair at snowdrifts higher than car level lining both sides of the road. The snow just blew your mind. It was right after a blizzard, and the roads were plowed, but the snow was piled up like I'd never seen it before, Vincent later remembered. Susan said that she had no idea snow got that big and tall. When we drove around Chicago, everything was fine and we were up and talking. And then it got real silent in the car when we saw this snow, and my father was trying to do everything to get everybody up again. We were going into a depression here. I'm thinking, where's he taking me? I don't think I want to do this. Green Bay was more a blur of white. Fresh snow was falling by the time they turned down West Mission Road in Alloway and spotted number 222, the two-story Georgian house on the corner. It snowed the rest of that afternoon and into the evening. They were invited to dinner at Dick and Lois Bourguignon's house, two blocks away on Warren Court. And throughout the meal, Vince and Marie and the children remarked on how unfailingly helpful and friendly the people of Green Bay had been. A man had already come down the street with a snowplow and cleared the drifts from the driveway and curb. A neighbor boy had shoveled the walk. The girl next door, Mary Jo Antle, had stopped by to see if Susan wanted to play. A clerk from the railroad station had brought out Ricky, the family dachshund, who had avoided the 3-day car trip, riding west in a cage on a train. The little wiener dog was nearly frozen from the winter haul and seemed discombobulated by his new environment, his feet so stiff that he kept tumbling down the stairs. This was a strange new world for all of them. On Monday morning, the new life began. Susan went off to St. Matthew's Parochial School. Vincent had decided to attend Green Bay Premontory, an all-male Catholic high school, where his first day was unlike anything he'd experienced back east. He felt like a celebrity or circus freak. The papers had built him up as a New Jersey football wonder, a 6'2", 210-pound running machine, exaggerating his talent and his stature by about 3 inches and 30 pounds. Even though his father had tried to present a more subdued assessment, telling the Green Bay Press that his son was only a fair to middling ball player. At lunch, when Vincent walked into the school cafeteria, he sensed 1,000 heads turn and 2,000 eyes focus on him, and he could hear the buzz. Marie walked next door and visited with Mary Antle, Mary Jo's mother, and was fascinated by her antique silver collection. She decided that she would collect silver herself. Mary was equally fascinated by Marie, especially her voice, deep and smoky, not the stereotypical Jersey accent with Jersey pronounced Joysy, but sharper, more like Jersey. The offices of the Green Bay Packers had been redecorated while Lombardi drove to Wisconsin with his family. During an earlier visit, he'd examined the quarters. Peeling walls, creaky floor, old leather chairs with holes in them. Discarded newspapers and magazines piled on chairs and in the corner. And pronounced the setting unworthy of a National Football League club. "This is a disgrace," he'd remarked to his new secretary, Ruth McCloskey. Walls were torn down, others repainted. Desks shifted, cubicles and counters constructed, new furniture brought in, all to give it a more professional appearance. For Lombardi's own office, which he had appropriated from Vern Llewellyn, he selected a wallpaper of tan burlap. McCloskey thought it looked strange and presented a health hazard, as she later remembered. "I almost died when they were putting it up because it was in great big rolls, and lint was flying out all over the room. The men putting it up were groaning the whole time. When Mrs. Lombardi finally came in, she said, 'Who in the world thought of this?' Mr. Lombardi was kind of sheepish about it. He thought it looked mannish." The style of the remodeled office in this instance was less important than the message Lombardi meant to impart. The hapless, losing ways of the old days were gone. The Green Bay Packers, as Lombardi called them, were starting over in the spirit of the new. "We're not just going to start with a clean slate," he said. "We're going to throw the old slate away." John Thurman Cochran and John Philip Bingston, two of Lombardi's four new assistants, reported for work that Monday morning, walking from the downtown YMCA at Pine and Jefferson, where they'd stayed overnight. Cochran, a feisty Alabaman who went by the nickname Red, had arrived from Detroit in what amounted to an informal swap, having been let go by Lions coach George Wilson to make room there for former Packer coach Scooter McClain. Bengston, a soft-spoken Minnesotan who was brought in from the San Francisco 49ers to run the defense, had originally expressed greater ambitions. He'd wired Olenicek the day after Scooter's resignation to say that he was interested in the top job. Cochran and Bengston, along with Bill Austin, a former New York Giants guard, the offensive line coach, and defensive backfield coach Norb Hecker, formerly of the Washington Redskins, all met Lombardi's first requirement for members of his staff. He wanted only assistants with professional experience. That standard would have precluded Lombardi himself from being hired by the Giants in 1954. But he remembered that his first year in New York had been a difficult adjustment and felt that there was no time for learning on the job now. He wanted to win immediately, and to do that, he needed people who knew the pro athletes and the pro game. In the job interviews, Lombardi focused intently on the arcane details of pro football, a variation of the pop quiz Red Blake had thrown at him in the Jim Tower office at West Point a decade earlier. What offenses the assistants knew, how they taught the sweep, the option, the belly series, the trap, the audible, rule blocking, making cuts, the 4-3 defense, man-on-man coverage. After the interview, conducted in a lounge at Willow Run Airport in Detroit while Lombardi was changing planes from New York to Green Bay, Cochran felt as though he had endured an entrance exam for football graduate school. Still, Red and Phil were not the most confident fellows as they walked up Pine to Washington Street and took a left toward the Packer offices that first Monday morning. With the wind whipping across the Fox River into their faces, Cochran looked up at a bank building and noticed a below-zero temperature reading. Tucking his chin deeper into his inadequate winter coat, he muttered to his new colleague, "What in the hell are we doing here?" Lombardi delivered no stirring speeches to his staff that first morning. No ringing pronouncements to define their mission, as Phil Bengston later remembered it. This did not mean that Lombardi disdained pep talks, but rather that he rarely interacted with his assistants in that manner, then or thereafter. He viewed them largely as technicians and teachers. He didn't expect them to be emotional leaders. He jealously guarded that role for himself and saved his emotion for his players. He wasn't inclined to cede power to his assistants or anyone else. On the night before his first meeting with the executive board, he stayed late at the office and went over his contract again with Secretary Ruth McCloskey, crossing out clauses that in any way appeared to limit his power. One that I distinctly remember him crossing out is a paragraph that he couldn't drink in public places, McCloskey later recalled. That was in the contract originally, and Mr. Lombardi said, "No one's going to tell me where I'm going to drink." An assertion of independence that he would not allow his players. At the board meeting, he announced that in the unlikely event that he needed help, he would ask for it. "I want it understood that I am in complete command," he declared. If President Olenicek still harbored notions of being the overseer, Lombardi quickly disabused him of those by usurping his parking space. His imperious leadership style was partly a manifestation of his innately bossy nature, shaped in childhood by his mother Mattie's perfectionist personality and his status as the oldest son and alpha wolf among the Izzo cousins, then refined at Fordham by Ignatius of Loyola, Father Cox, and the Jesuits, from whom he learned the philosophy of sublimating individual desires for the common good. and further influenced by several strong leaders he encountered during his football career. From Harry Kane at St. Francis, through Sleepy Jim Crowley and Frank Leahy at Fordham, Red Blake, Red Reader, and Douglas MacArthur at West Point, and Paul Brown and George Halas in the National Football League. Past was prologue for Lombardi in all of those ways, but his present circumstances also played a role in determining the coaching persona he assumed with the Packers. He felt that he had to be the antithesis of the happy-go-lucky Scooter McClain, and part of that necessarily meant distancing himself from the people in a small, busybody town. He'd given considerable thought to the adjustment he would have to make. He mused aloud one day, not only the psychological transition from assistant to boss, but also the cultural shift from New York to Green Bay. "I realize it will be different here, where most everybody knows everyone else," he said. "The coaches and players have an entirely different problem compared to those in large cities who can easily get lost." The one matter that required the least adjustment from Lombardi's New York days was football itself. He brought the Giants' offense with him and set about teaching it to his assistants that first week, using his football Bible, the tan satchel, and a chalkboard as his pedagogical tools. "We knew Lombardi was going to be disciplined because he started with us on day one," Cochran said later. "Every day, Vince took a certain amount of time that we sat down and went through football just like we were learning it for the first time. He was on the blackboard teaching us with the same techniques that we eventually would use with players. He told us what plays we were going to run, how they were going to be blocked. We were making up our own notebooks at the time, putting all the plays on cards like he had. 8.5 by 11-inch notebook cards with holes in them, just like his Bible. I'd call mine my brains. I'd say I left my brains somewhere if I didn't have my notebook. It was Lombardi's brains." If Lombardi knew exactly the type of football he wanted to see on the field, he was less certain about the players he would put out there. His knowledge of the roster was limited. Since they came from different conferences, the Giants and Packers had rarely played against each other and had few common opponents. One was the Baltimore Colts. No heartening news there. The Colts split with the Giants in 1958, losing in the regular season before winning the dramatic sudden-death game, but they obliterated the Packers on the most miserable afternoon of Scooter McClain's sad sack season, 56-0. Since his days with Red Blake, Lombardi had been a true believer in the value of game films, and now he found them more important than ever. He set up a film room on the second floor of the Washington Street office and studied reels of old Packer films late into the night, as he and his assistants graded the technique, speed, and hustle of every player. It didn't take him long to make his first crucial decision. His offense was built around the left halfback position, which in New York was filled by Frank Gifford, the triple threat star who could run the sweep, throw the option pass, and catch passes out in the flat. Could any Packer play Gifford's role? In the dark hum of the film room, Lombardi found his answer. He was watching Paul Hornung, who had been an option quarterback in college and had been used by McClain at quarterback, fullback, and halfback. Hornung loped out of the backfield at left halfback one game, followed his blockers perfectly, and cut upfield through the tackle slot with power and ease. "Run that play again!" Lombardi barked to Bill Austin, the line coach operating the projector. It wasn't raw speed that Lombardi was looking for. Gifford was not the fastest back around, but a combination of timing, grace, power, and determination. He watched Hornung again and again. The Heisman winner from Notre Dame, disappointing in his first 2 years, had what Lombardi sought. "There's my offense," he said. The next morning he placed a call to Hornung, who was home in Louisville, disillusioned with football, making money in real estate development with his family friend and patron, Henry Hoffman, and thinking of retiring from the game. "I want you to know one thing. You're not going to be my quarterback," Lombardi told him. "Your quarterback days are over. You won't have to worry about playing three positions anymore. You're my left halfback. You're my Frank Gifford. You're either going to be my left halfback, or you're not going to make it in pro football." Hornung knew about Gifford and his success in New York, and hung up, eager to give Green Bay one more chance. "I had been ready to bail out," he said years later, "and would have, if Lombardi hadn't called." It was easier for Lombardi to decide on a halfback than a quarterback. He'd removed Hornung from consideration, and Randy Duncan, the first-round choice from Iowa, had decided to play in Canada. That left Lombardi with three choices from the remaining material. Vito, Babe, Perilli, who had been in the league since 1952, but hadn't yet been able to repeat the success he had at Kentucky. Joe Francis, a second-year man from Oregon State who had played mostly halfback in his rookie year. And Bart Starr, a late-round draft choice in his third year from Alabama. Starr had shown glimmers of talent. In one game film Lombardi studied, Starr attempted 46 passes, completing 26 for 320 yards. But he seemed more mistake-prone than Perilli, with four times as many interceptions as touchdowns. Bengston's analysis of Starr was that he might prove adequate as a backup, but no more. "We've got a hell of a problem," Lombardi agreed. "We've got to find somebody who can move this club." The dominant figure in the Packers clubhouse during the long dry spell of the 50s was not a quarterback, but an end. Billy Houghton, who'd been both a star receiver and a leader of the incipient National Football League Players Association. Houghton was a tall Texan, quick and cocky, the sort who would return to the huddle and announce that he could get open on a deep fly pattern if only the quarterback could throw it that far. One night in February, Gary Kniffel, another Packers end who was Houghton's roommate during the season and lived in Green Bay during the off-season, got a call from Houghton, who was back in Dallas. "Vince called me," Houghton began. "Wait a minute, Billy. I sure wouldn't call him Vince," Kniffel cautioned his buddy. Kniffel had already had his first encounter with Lombardi. They had met in the stands at a Green Bay Bobcats minor league hockey game, and came away scared to death of him. Houghton was undeterred, telling Kniffel that Vince wanted him to catch a flight to Green Bay and talk about how we could make the Packers a winner. He asked Kniffel to pick him up at the airport. Kniffel had one last word of advice before hanging up. "Billy," he said, "I'm going to tell you again, I would not call him Vince." The next day, when Kniffel picked up Houghton at the airport, Houghton said that he expected to spend several hours with Lombardi and made arrangements for dinner with the Kniffels that night and for a return flight to Dallas the next morning. "So I dropped him off, and my wife had some errands for me to run at Prangy's," Kniffel later recalled. "I went there and got back home, and my wife says, 'Bill wants you to pick him up right away. He's got to get back to Dallas.' And I say, 'I just dropped him off.' And she says, 'Well, he's waiting for you.' So I drove down to the office on Washington Street, and he's standing on the corner and gets in, and he's silent, and I say, 'What happened?' And he says, 'Nothing,' and wouldn't talk about it anymore." What happened is that Lombardi had decided to get rid of Houghton, who before long was traded to the Cleveland Browns for halfback Lou Carpenter and defensive end Bill Quinlan. Houghton was among those who believed that he was shipped out of Green Bay because of his union position, which Lombardi might have perceived as a threat to his autocracy. That view appears to be half true at best. It's certain that Lombardi wanted nothing, certainly not a players' organization, to get between him and his team. But Lombardi had no similar difficulties with Kyle Rote, who'd been a players' association activist with the Giants, nor with the Packers' player representatives, who succeeded Houghton. His decision to trade Houghton was triggered by their prickly meeting in Green Bay, at which the coach concluded that the wide receiver was a divisive force, but at bottom it resulted from a cold assessment of personnel. Lombardi was a skilled offensive coach, but he came to Green Bay realizing that he had to build a great defense to prevail in the NFL, just as the Giants had, and thought that Bill Quinlan, a freewheeling defender from Michigan State who had a reputation for being every bit as rebellious as Houghton, would be more valuable to him. It was a talent appraisal that improved the team, as did most of the trades Lombardi made as general manager preparing for his first season as head coach. He acquired another lineman from Cleveland, Henry Jordan, a future all-star tackle, to fortify the defense, and also picked up Emlem Tanal, the veteran all-star safety from the Giants, both for mid-round draft choices. For the offense, he brought in guard Fred Fuzzy Thurston in a trade with Baltimore, and quarterback Lamar McCann from the Chicago Cardinals. Quinlan and Jordan constituted half of the Packers' front four. M. Tunnell, who had intercepted 74 passes during 11 years of ball hawking in New York, brought class and experience to the defensive backfield, along with an intimate knowledge of the defensive system Lombardi wanted to implement with his new team. Tunnell became an informal coach on the field, and as the first black star to play for the Packers, and a player who greatly respected the new coach, he also made it easier for Lombardi to bring in many more skilled black players over the next few years. Thurston, an agile basketball player in college at Valparaiso, fit perfectly at left guard in Lombardi's sweep offense. McCann, who'd always played well for his underdog Cardinals when they'd faced the Giants during Lombardi's New York years, was brought in as the favorite to be the starting quarterback. Lombardi vacillated between optimism and despair during those early days in Green Bay. He was Mr. High-Low again. At times he was surprised by joy, the feeling that overtook him back at St. Francis Prep in Brooklyn, when he first realized that he loved football. Now football in Green Bay was his whole world, and he was the master of it, a sublime state of freedom that the Jesuits and Colonel Blake, in different ways, had predicted would be his if he was disciplined, obedient, willing to pay the price. Now he was even free to relax and show some of the jovial Harry in him. One night, during their first week in town, he stunned his son, Vincent, twice. First by asking if he wanted to go to a hockey game, then by picking up two hitchhikers on the way to the arena, something he'd never done back in New Jersey. One of the hitchhikers became young Vincent's best friend at school. Pat Cochran, the wife of assistant coach Red Cochran, was brought to tears late one Sunday morning as she struggled with the difficult conditions she found herself in. Trapped by snow in an alien city, two toddlers, not enough room or furniture, her infant daughter sleeping in a dresser drawer. Red looked out the window and was shocked to see that Lombardi had stopped off on his way back from church and was now walking up their front steps. "Here comes the old man," Red said, opening the door. After surmising that Pat was not having any fun here, Lombardi invited the Cochrans over for dinner. "It was the best time I ever had with him," she said later. "We were all in the same boat. I remember Vince let their little dachshund out to piddle, and he laughed and laughed about the way it melted the snow." A week later, Lombardi invited the entire staff out to the house on Mission Street for a party. Not just the football people, but also the secretaries and clerks and their spouses. Marie had the food catered, and Vince played bartender. The guests were nervous and hesitant at first, uncertain about how to behave in an informal setting with Mr. Lombardi. After a few drinks, Pat Cochran said her feet hurt. "Anyone mind if I take off my shoes?" she asked, flinging her high heels aside. The other women were startled, and a moment of awkward silence passed until Lombardi broke into his toothy grin and said, "That's a good idea. Let's all take our shoes off." He untied his wingtips and lined them up at the side of the couch. "This feels good," he said, wiggling his toes. He was still in his stocking feet at the end of the night, standing at the door, saying goodbye. But on other days, Lombardi felt isolated and out of his element. Yes, he was master of this world, but what kind of world was it? There was more excitement on one block of Midtown Manhattan, or the Grand Concourse in the Bronx, or Sheepshead Bay Road out in Brooklyn, than in all of this dark, snow-slushed, wide, and empty place. In a strange environment, the most trivial deprivation can feed the largest worry. He couldn't find a hard breakfast roll anywhere in town. His team might not be any good. Both thoughts jangled around in his mind, increasing his anxiety. Yes, he had freedom, but that meant freedom to fail. Late one afternoon, after being closeted in the film room since 8 in the morning, he slumped down the stairs and sat behind his desk in brooding silence with his head in his hands. Ruth McCloskey had never seen him disconsolate before. She'd known only the assertive side of his personality, and his melancholy alarmed her. When she looked closer from across the room, it appeared that her new boss had tears in his eyes. She walked over to him and asked what was wrong. As McCloskey later recounted the scene, he said, "I think I've taken on more than I can handle. Will you pray for me and help me?" As the long northern winter persisted through February, March, and April, Lombardi and his staff huddled inside the office on Washington Street, grading film and analyzing personnel. In May, they finally took their first look at a few players when the quarterbacks were flown in for a weekend minicamp. But even then, there was no throwing. It was brains Lombardi wanted to deal with first, not arms. Lamar McCann, Bart Starr, and Joe Francis, as well as a few receivers who happened to be in town, were taken up to the second-floor film area, where a classroom had been created for them. Lombardi handed out the playbooks and worked with them the first morning on the terminology of his offense. "We're going to take a giant step backward, gentlemen," he began. By that, he meant that he was asking his quarterbacks to forget everything they knew about plays and play calling, to empty their brains so that he could fill them up again with his system, his knowledge. He would teach it to them, just as he had taught physics at St. Cecilia in the early 40s, so that the slowest person in the room understood everything he said, writing it in chalk on a blackboard. "A coach must be a pedagogue," he once explained. "He has to pound the lessons into the players by rote, the same way you teach pupils in the classroom." The quarterbacks had never experienced anything like this. Scooter McLean's playbook, based on a Clark Shaughnessy system that he had brought from the Bears, was more than 4 inches thick, as was the one McCann had used with the Chicago Cards. Lombardi's was 1.5 inches. Scooter's plays were wordy and needlessly complicated. Lombardi's were clear and easy to remember. To call an end sweep in the old days, the quarterback had to recite a nonsensical rataplan of names and numbers. 49 Billo, Grace Ed, or 49 M.O., Grace Pop. With Lombardi, the same play was just 49. The 4 signified the formation, and 9 the hole. Simple as that. In other systems, the quarterback called blocking patterns for offensive linemen. With Lombardi, blocking calls were left to the linemen themselves. There were fewer plays, but more options within each play. Yet Lombardi taught the quarterbacks how to read the defense and select from the options in a rational way so that they didn't feel overwhelmed. Freedom through discipline and simplicity. He also presented the logic of each play. They call it coaching, but it's teaching, he once explained. You do not just tell them it is so, but you show them the reasons why it is so, and you repeat and repeat until they are convinced, until they know. It might sound unimaginative, but there was in this a touch of Lombardi's genius. Even in his repetitive drills, he had a way of making the mundane seem important. The football variation of a masterly novelist who could take the muddle of everyday life and bring clarity and sense to it and allow readers to see for the first time what was in front of their eyes all along. Bart Starr was on the edge of his seat, listening, getting it for the first time. All the crap was gone. This was right to the bone, simple yet so refreshing and exciting, Starr thought. Everything was accounted for, labeled, identified, put in order, fundamental and sound. You could tell that the coach believed in what he was doing. His tone of voice, his posture, his manner, it all made you believe. It all made sense. Starr knew, after the first 20 minutes, that Lombardi was giving them a new world, and from then on he felt an insatiable hunger for more. When the players took their first break late that morning, Starr ran downstairs, found a payphone, and called his wife Cherry in Birmingham. "I think we're going to begin to win," he blurted into the phone. There are two Green Bays, the city and the bay. The bay is part of Lake Michigan, as it curls around the Door County Peninsula, which sticks out from the coastline of northeastern Wisconsin like a disjointed pinky finger, or cursive lowercase I, if one thinks of Washington Island as the point that dots it. The city rests at the bottom of the namesake bay, yet the two seem only incidentally connected. Up through the Door County Peninsula, the bay defines the life of artisans, merchants, and the tourists who live and vacation in Wisconsin's summer resort Mecca. A land of fish boils, cherry orchards, antique barns, gentle coves, and radiant northern sunsets. But down at the bottom, where the city meets the bay, the shoreline is blotted by an industrial scattering of warehouses, port facilities, and oil and gas storage terminals. The bay may have brought the city into being when French traders settled there 3 centuries ago, but it long since had stopped being central to the urban existence. A visitor could spend days in the city without seeing the bay. One New York sports writer, in fact, traveled to Green Bay scores of times over 4 decades and never caught sight of it. The city of Green Bay has always been defined by another body of water, the Fox River, which cuts through the middle of it, dividing the city equally east and west. In its culture, economy, and civic architecture, Vince Lombardi's new hometown was in essence a river city. The low-lying downtown hugged the Fox River, and so did the huge mills operated by Charmin, Fort Howard, Nicolet, and Northern that transformed pulpwood into paper towels, napkins, and toilet paper for an entire nation. There was nothing beautiful about the Fox as it wended through town, 200 yards across, vital and polluted. In the winter, fishermen built huts on the frozen sheet and dropped lines through holes in the ice, while dense gray and white plumes of factory smoke curled overhead. With all of Green Bay's comfortable old neighborhoods, there also came the transient underbelly of a river city. The rail yards, empty lots and flophouses on the edge of downtown, the big stakes all-night poker game at the Hotel Beaumont, the smoky gambling joint above a supper club called The Spot, run by old man Wally Adomini. The river helped delineate Green Bay society. The upper class and working class tended to live in older neighborhoods east of the river, while the upwardly mobile middle class found more room to grow on the newer west side of town. Lombardi crossed the river bridges almost every day. His daughter attended school on the east side, his son on the west. His home on Mission Street and office on Washington Street were both east of the Fox. The stadium was across the river on the west side, as were the practice fields and airport. His country club, Oneida Golf and Riding, was west. His church, St. Willibrord, was on Adams Street in the east. Only a few miles south of Green Bay sits De Pere, another bridge town split in half by the Fox, with an old downtown on the east side and St. Norbert College nestled above the western bank at one of the more scenic points along the river. The Norbertine priests who ran the small Catholic college in West De Pere wielded influence in the Green Bay area far beyond their numbers. They were casually known as the White Fathers, from the white robes that they wore. They were recruited from Holland by the Bishop of Green Bay in 1893 because they were fluent in Flemish and Walloon, and it was hoped that they might counteract a heretic preacher who had been proselytizing among Belgium immigrant farmers in Door County. Over the decades, they'd established a small religious and academic empire in their new land, operating an elementary school, high school, Promontory, Young Vincent School, and parish church, St. Willibrord, in Green Bay, and an abbey and St. Norbert College in De Pere. Like the Jesuits who had shaped Lombardi's life at Fordham and the Carmelites he befriended at St. Cecilia in Englewood, the White Fathers tended to be gregarious fellows who played active roles in community life and held many of the same interests as the people they served. They could be seen hacking around the local golf courses and were fanatical about Packer football, and were delighted that Vince Lombardi, the new coach who took daily communion at their church in downtown Green Bay, had agreed to keep preseason training camp at St. Norbert. On Thursday evening, July 23rd, Lombardi stood at the front entrance of St. Norbert's Sensenbrenner Hall and shook hands with the first-year men, quarterbacks, and centers, the first wave of players to report for 1959 training camp. A month earlier, he had reached his 46th birthday. He had waited since the summer of 1946, his last season as head coach at Saints, for a moment like this, when he could work with players from the first day of camp and have the power to shape them into a team in his image. As he described it later, those were 13 very long years, especially for a fellow with a naturally explosive temper and a seething impatience. But perhaps he was fortunate that he had to wait so long. When his time arrived, he was exuding a sense that he knew precisely what to do. And now here came the first troops, the rookies and handful of veterans moving through the receiving line of coaches that summer evening. Lombardi stood upright, all teeth and firm grip, with a friendly comment for each of them. "Good to see you. Welcome to the Packers. Look at those hands, Phil. Then he came across what he took to be an adolescent interloper. "What the hell are you doing here? This line isn't for kids," Lombardi snapped. To which Billy Butler, who was at least 2 inches and 20 pounds shorter and lighter than his program statistics of 5'10" and 180 pounds, replied, "Well, you drafted me. Ain't I supposed to show up?" Butler was a Wisconsin boy from the small town of Berlin who had returned kicks and played defensive back at Chattanooga and was drafted by Jack Vanisi for the Packers in the 19th round. Had Blackjack lost his magic personnel touch? Not really. Butler was a tenacious athlete who became one of only 3 rookies to make the team. The others were Boyd Dowler, a rangy flanker from Colorado, and an offensive lineman from Northwestern named Andy Sverko. It was not Venisi's fault that Lombardi failed to find a place on the roster for an obscure running back from Ball State, drafted in the 27th round named Timmy Brown, who went on to a sterling career with the Philadelphia Eagles, or that Lombardi didn't like Alex Hawkins, another all-purpose back drafted into the second round out of South Carolina, who was picked up by the Colts and played in the league 12 years. Lombardi was operating in that first training camp with two assumptions that he carried with him for the next decade. First, he preferred veterans to rookies, even when starting from scratch. And second, he wanted only a certain type of athlete who was willing to play for him, even if the player disliked him. Lombardi might never have known that little Billy Butler couldn't stand him. "Lombardi was the biggest asshole I ever met in my life," Butler said later. But he did know that Butler went all out from the first day of camp. The veterans were not due to report until Saturday night, but Max McGee, an end, and Howie Ferguson, a fullback, arrived in town late Friday morning and decided to stop by St. Norbert for lunch. After eating with the rookies, the two southern boys with Louisiana roots, Ferguson was from New Iberia, McGee was from East Texas but went to Tulane, took off again. They hit the local bars, partied late into the night, crashed at a downtown hotel, and checked into camp the next day as scheduled. Lombardi was waiting for them, enraged. "He's ready to run us off, and we've just met the guy," McGee remembered. Ferguson was in no mood for the tirade. "What the hell, we're not due till today," he snapped. "Irrelevant," said Lombardi. They had come under his watch by eating a meal at camp the previous day. "Once you do that, you're part of this organization." McGee had the outward ease of a free spirit, but in fact hated confrontation, it upset his stomach, and he accepted Lombardi's dictate. Ferguson continued arguing, and soon enough, like Billy Houghton before him, he was gone. On Sunday evening, Lombardi addressed the full squad inside Sensenbrenner Hall. He'd been rehearsing riffs in the speech for months, turning it over in his mind from the time he had driven up to Green Bay with his family that snowy day in February. He started with the practical. First the playbooks. They were important. The Bible. "Here's what happens if you lose one." Then the practices. He would keep them tight and exact. An hour and a half, twice a day, the way Colonel Blake had taught him, and the players would know exactly what they were supposed to be doing every minute. There was much to learn, so he expected them to be on time. West Point time, hereafter known as Lombardi time, which meant 10 minutes early. Meetings would start at 9, not 5 minutes after 9. Get there ahead of time, prepared. He promised to be relentless, driving constantly. "With every fiber of my body, I've got to make you the best football player that I can make you. And I'll try, and I'll try. And if I don't succeed the first day, I'll try again, and I'll try again. And you've got to give everything that's in you. You've got to keep yourself in prime physical condition, because fatigue makes cowards of us all." He would have no tolerance for the half-hearted, the defeatist, the loser. The goal was to be the New York Yankees of football. World champions, every day, year-round, admired everywhere. No more T-shirts on the road, team blazers and ties for everyone. Wherever you go, you represent the team. You will talk like, you will look like, and you will act like the most dignified professional in your hometown. Relentless in the pursuit of victory. Only winners. Anyone who didn't like it was perfectly free to get the hell out right now. "There are trains, planes, and buses leaving here every day, and if you don't produce for me, you're gonna find yourself on one of them." No one walked out. There was silence until Lombardi cleared his throat and smiled sheepishly and said, "Gentlemen," and gestured that the meeting was over. As the players filtered out, Lombardi caught Max McGee's glance and nudged him over to the corner, just the two of them. McGee had been in the league since 1954, the same year Lombardi joined the pro ranks. He had been through Ronzani and Blackburn and Scooter McLean, and he had never witnessed anything quite like what Lombardi had just done. To him, it was as though they'd worked in the dark for 5 years, and someone came in and turned on the lights. Lombardi couldn't read McGee's face, but there was something about the veteran's open manner that softened him, allowing him to reveal uncertainties that he usually kept hidden. "What do you think?" Lombardi asked. "Well, I'll tell you. You got their attention, coach," McGee responded. "There's no doubt about that." "You know, I wasn't sure," Lombardi confided. "Everybody could have gotten up and walked out for all I knew." Some players might have considered walking out during the next week. The practice sessions seemed brutal compared to the lackadaisical training they'd undertaken with Scooter a year earlier. 3 laps around the goalposts at the start, then 20 minutes of calisthenics, West Point style, ending with the up-down grass drill, running in place, Lombardi striding through the ranks. "Where is he? Get those knees up, Knaffel. Keep those legs moving. Front! Dive in your stomach. Up! Pop back up. Where is he now? Who's he looking at? Hogg's going down and he isn't coming up." Hogg was Joel David Hanner, the defensive tackle whose nickname perfectly captured his rural Arkansas roots and voracious appetite. Since joining the Packers in 1952, Hogg had made a habit of eating his way through the off-season and slowly working his way into shape. His blubber was deceptive. Even after Hogg had indulged at the trough, no one wanted to line up against him and discover once again that he was quicker and stronger. He checked into camp weighing 278 pounds, massive by the standards of that era. But after 2 days of Lombardi drills, he lost 18 pounds. And at the end of the up-downs on the second afternoon, he keeled over from sunstroke and ended up at the appropriately named St. Vincent Hospital, taking liquids intravenously. He thought he was finished, but came back and found that the toughest grind he ever encountered became easier day by day as he lost weight, until he was down to playing shape at 250. Young Vincent was there observing it all under the searing summer sun, attending his 6th training camp with his father, this time as an assistant to Dad Brasher, the equipment manager. He was the ball boy and water boy, though the old man barely believed in water. Players were discouraged from sipping water during most of practice. Vincent would sneak them ice cubes and towels soaked in ice water, which they could suck on. They were bitching and moaning under their breath. "Guadalcanal," Billy Butler called it. "Bring us some goddamn vodka," another muttered one afternoon. They weren't sure about the kid at first. He looked like Lombardi, had the same name, but M. Tunnell quickly spread the word. "You don't have to worry about Junior. The boy's not going to tell any tales out of school." It was the same as with the Giants. Vincent worshipped the players, but had mixed feelings about the coach. When the father yelled, the son winced. He identified with players who were in the most trouble or most rebellious. The bond strengthened whenever Lombardi snapped at him too, which was almost every day. "Get that ball over there! You know better than that, mister!" When Ray Nitschke arrived in camp after finishing summer training with the Army, Dad Brasher sidled up to him with a warning for the obstreperous young linebacker. "Ray, hey, Ray, Ray, look, it's not like it used to be." First, Hogg Hanner was taken to St. Vincent, then two rookies. "Geez, that first camp was tough. They were dropping like flies," said Vincent later. If someone dropped a pass, the old man shouted, "That's a lap!" and ran the offender around the goalposts again. One day, Lombardi raged at M. Tonnell, ordering him off the practice field twice to run punitive laps. But Vincent and M. were the only ones wise to the old man's trick. Lombardi was using M., his old friend from the Giants, to demonstrate to the others that even a veteran all-star was not above discipline on his team. Tonnell knew the routine and could take it. But others, who'd never seen it before, were stunned. Art Daly of the Press Gazette witnessed it from the sidelines and later said he thought to himself, "Vince Lombardi is a cruel bastard." Controlled violence is what Lombardi called football, and he didn't consider the phrase an oxymoron. The violence was as important to him as the control. He distinguished controlled violence from brutality, which he said ultimately defeats itself. But he didn't try to minimize the role of violence. To approach football any other way, he said, would be idiotic. Every play began with a series of planned collisions, one man hitting, another hitting back, up and down the line. That was the pure element of the sport, the first Lombardi commandment. Thou shalt hit. Hit me. He first heard those words as a freshman at Fordham during the opening week of practice up on the scrimmage field at Rose Hill, with Frank Leahy, the line coach, standing across from him and demanding a thwack. Come on, hit me. So Lombardi had ordered his little saints in the twilight at McKay Park in Englewood, taking them on one by one, man against man-child. For the Packers, Lombardi instituted a drill called the Nutcracker that became his symbol of controlled violence. Two blocking dummies were placed horizontally on the field about 5 yards apart. The action had to take place within that confined space. The quarterback handed off to a running back who ran for daylight between the dummies, but even the runner was incidental to the play. The violence was between an offensive lineman, blocking for the runner, and a defender who had to try to fight off the blocker and make the tackle. The defender's advantage was that he knew the play was a run. The blocker's only advantage was that he knew the snap count, allowing him to get in the first lick. The Nutcracker was Lombardi's test of manhood for offensive linemen, according to Bob Skoronski, the big left tackle from Indiana, who was returning to the pro game in 1959 after missing 2 years for military service. Skoronski knew that many factors could help him make a block during a game. The defensive formation, the uncertainty of the defender about pass or run, the double teaming with another blocker. But with the Nutcracker drill, there was nothing to make it easier, no escaping it, as Skoronski said. If you didn't have the courage to get your head in and get that guy out of there, the Nutcracker would expose you. Coach Lombardi loved it. He would be right in the midst of it, hovering over you, urging you on. He would get so excited about a good block. Most of the players, especially on offense, did not share their coach's enthusiasm. As Gary Kanafel, the tight end, waited in line for his turn, he gazed anxiously across the way to the corresponding line of defenders, counting back to see which one he would have to face. No one wanted Hanner, the immovable object, but Kanafel most feared Ray Nitschke, a second-year linebacker out of Illinois who seemed to be salivating for his chance to slap and whack and pound the hell out of him. And there stood Lombardi, pushing for more. The image lingers. For any examination of Lombardi as a leader inevitably leads to the subject of pain. The infliction of pain is an unavoidable part of professional football. Pain is suffered by most players on almost every play. Football is hitting, and hitting causes pain. In other professions, pain is largely mental or symbolic, a word used to denote hard effort or the enduring of a difficult process. In football, pain is those things as well, but it begins with the physical, throbbing, aching, piercing, dizzying, screaming, vomiting, fear-inducing, and fear-conquering pain. It's misleading to say that Lombardi was a sadistic coach who derived satisfaction from the pain of his players, even if that were true on a superficial level. It misses a larger meaning of pain in Lombardi's view of the world. He operated from a philosophy of pain, complex and contradictory, woven from the geographic, cultural, religious, and physical threads of his life. Images of pain shaped his ancestral homeland of southern Italy. Both the Neapolitan region of his father's Lombardies and the remote mountain village of Vietri di Potenza, home to his mother's Izzo clan. The people of southern Italy shared a history of pain on the largest scale fathomable. Centuries of earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, mudslides, epidemics, revolts, famines, invasions, counter-reformations, a communal memory of the works of man collapsing, crumbling, shaking, corpses burning, bodies thrown into the sea. In southern Italy, pain was a constant of the human condition, the defining theme of religion and art. Paintings of flagellation, crucifixion, stigmata, biblical tragedies, luminous and muscular, with intimations of breathtaking pain. Pain was its own reward, to be endured, gloried, but not overcome. Of course, that's not to say that anyone whose heritage traces back to southern Italy would have a propensity for pain, merely that in Lombardi's case, the general historical thread connected to his specific family history. During his life in the New World of Sheepshead Bay and Fordham, Saints, and West Point, pain existed more within the reach and control of man. His mother disciplined him with pain, believing it could bring him closer to perfection. His father insisted to him that pain did not exist, that it was only in his mind, that it indeed could be overcome through persistence and denial. Pain was an aspect of Jesuitical free will, endured not with resignation but by choice, not from fear but out of hope. The penance of pain was accepted as a ritual leading to something more noble than individual desire. Paying the price, in Red Blake's phrase, meant withstanding and conquering pain. Pain was a means to an end, not an end in itself. The art was not in the pain but in what pain created, tireless, fearless, unbeatable men. To succumb to pain for no greater purpose was to accept defeat. That's why Lombardi drove his men toward pain, and it's why he was so distraught during the first week of practice when he entered the Green Bay training room one morning and saw more than a dozen players seeking treatment for minor bumps and bruises and lounging in the whirlpool. Serious injuries were one thing, but this looked like malingering. "What is this, an emergency casualty ward?" he thundered, according to his later account. "This has got to stop. This is disgraceful. I have no patience with the small hurts that are bothering most of you." The next morning, the training room was virtually empty. Lombardi's philosophy of pain was intensified by the contradictions of his own experience. He was constantly fighting his vulnerability to pain. He had a low pain threshold, and his athletic career was littered with injuries large and small that took him off the field. At his first high school, the pre-seminary Cathedral Prep, which didn't even have a football team, the joke was that Lombardi has more injuries than Hoover has commissions. At Fordham, he missed most of his freshman year, part of his sophomore year, and 3 games in his junior year to injuries. His susceptibility to injury was matched only by his determination to recover. When he became a coach, the football trainers often treated Lombardi for minor complaints that he would not tolerate among his players. Sore joint, headache, hangnail, nervous stomach. He always had something bothering him. It's a characteristic of many leaders that they confront their own weaknesses indirectly by working to eliminate them in others, strengthened in that effort by their intimate knowledge of frailty. So it was with Lombardi and Payne. It was in seeking a triumph of character and will both for himself and the team that he exhorted his Packers to confront Payne and stood there laughing as Ray Nitschke pounded the hell out of another blocker in the nutcracker drill.